Hi, I'm Bill Anderson, and just ahead on Central Standard, the return of nature in the city. Guiding our expedition, two experts on the wild creatures that share space with us. The eagles are around, find out what they're doing, plus get the story behind the hundreds of crows you've probably seen roosting on trees and rooftops. Have the armadillos given up on our sometimes frigid climate? On our Facebook page, Betsy writes, in the 435 and State Line area, she's hearing coyotes and seeing owls. What are you seeing? Let us know. Spring is not far off. Let's get an update on movement in the natural world. It's Central Standard, following the news from NPR. Hi, and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. Today, one of the longest-standing episodes in the 10 o'clock hour, Nature in the City. We're here to talk about brushes with creatures. We want to hear about your experience, and our two experts can help explain what otherwise may appear to be peculiar or bizarre. Later in the hour, we'll talk to a KCUR staffer who's been curious, perhaps even obsessive, about the onslaught of crows in the metropolitan area. This morning, our capable Sherpas, Larry Rizzo, a natural history biologist. Good morning.
Good morning, Bill.
And we welcome back Joe Werner, biologist and urban ecologist.
Morning, Bill.
Gents, let's start with the weather. Today, we could hit a record high, and then come Thursday, we may be down to about 10 degrees. This has to have, Joe, let's start with you. Well, this has to have an effect on animal life.
It's really amazing because right now we're starting to see some of the animals become more active. And even just over at the Anita Gorman Discovery Center this morning, the robins were singing. They're trying to, you know, get ready for the spring mating season. A lot of birds are moving back north now, while some of the birds, you know, like the geese, are still moving south. It's just really kind of a crazy situation out here. And again, you know, the animals like groundhogs. Uh-huh. You know, they typically, we got Groundhog Day coming up here. They'll be waking up usually, you know, early in February and, you know, getting their season started. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
So does a critter sometimes wake up early, a critter that hibernates, and does that put it at some risk, Larry?
Well, it could, Bill. I'm really happy, though, that this little blast of warm air seems pretty short-lived. Now, it would be more dangerous if we had warm weather like this time of year that lasted, say, a week or better part of a week, where you might get more animals and plants fooled into thinking it's spring and coming out. And yeah, it can potentially be harmful for some of them.
We usually get a January thaw, and mm-hmm. like Larry said, it's usually not very prolonged, and that's when some interesting things start happening, like, the cedar waxwings that will be eating hawthorn berries and literally getting drunk on them and uh-huh. flying into windows. We've had people call in, you know, wondering about that on past shows.
Wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
It actually has an alcoholic.
The sugars in the hawthorn berries will turn to alcohols and they literally get disoriented.
Oh my. Let's bring our listeners into this conversation, either on Facebook or on telephone. What have you seen out there? What experiences with wildlife have you had recently? 816-235-2888, 235-2888. Joe, have you seen anything recently that stands out in your mind?
You know, this is one of the best times of the year, Bill, I think, to get out and observe nature. And Kansas City is so full of wonderful nature centers, nature trails, public parkways, you know, to observe things. You know, just this last weekend I was out, and boy, the barred owls were just very, very active. They're starting to nest right now. Great horned owls are starting to nest. So things like that are just really starting to pop.
Larry.
Well, we do think of this as being in the heart of the winter, but as Joe points out, there are lots of signs of spring and renewal already going on. The great horned owls nesting. There are birds it's just a mixed up time of year. There are birds that have just arrived here for the winter, and others on the rebound. They're already on their way back, and so it's more of a transitional time than people might think.
So will the geese, and I see geese everywhere I go. Will they continue south, or will they say, to heck with it, I'm heading back north?
It depends which ones you're talking mm-hmm. about and when. It could be one or all or the above. And snow geese tend to the huge flocks of the mainly white geese that we see. They tend to linger around here nowadays in winter much longer than they ever used to. Mm-hmm. It's a factor of open water being available to them and having lots and lots of crop fields to feed in.
Mm-hmm. And the Canada geese are year-round residents here, so people are pretty familiar with those. It's really become an urban bird.
Speaking of bird life, Jeffrey writes on Facebook, I used to have a squirrel problem. Now my squirrels have a hawk problem. And I've even noted that in my neighborhood, that the hawk will come and rest on the deck in the backyard.
The cycle of life.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Good example.
They're looking to prey on other animals. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good thing, bad thing. Are we enabling them in some fashion?
It's just the way it is.
Have a lot of people with a lot of even animosity towards squirrels when they chew up your bird feeders or get in your attic. So those people would probably welcome hawks. Other people, maybe not so much. So it just depends on your perspective. Yeah, but it's part of the big picture.
And one of my colleagues here at the station was speaking disparagingly about bunnies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and they've been incredibly – well, they always are, I guess, but I've seen a lot of rabbits throughout the winter.
You know, it's amazing. I was driving down 95th Street the other day and saw a red-tailed hawk in somebody's front yard eating a rabbit.
Yeah, wow.
It happens.
They're more common in the urban area to me than they used to be. Cooper's hawks and red-tailed hawks both. Mm-hmm. And Cooper's being a bird-eating hawk and red-tail's more into the rodents.
Let's go right to the phones, and I think we have Joe. Joe calling in. Good morning, sir. Well, I think we're having a bit of an issue with our phones here, so we'll remedy that. And in the meantime, 235-2888. It won't take us long to reset our phone lines. We'd like to hear from you because it's important to hear about your experiences with animal life. I had a couple of hikes over the weekend. I called it show research. And I spent some time just outside Lawrence on the Kaw River, saw a bald eagle the first day, and then I saw two the second day. One of them was probably the same one I saw on Saturday. Mm-hmm. But it's just, I don't know, I can't describe the experience of seeing a bald eagle in the wild. How are they doing these days, Larry?
Terrific. When I was young, it's one of those species I can remember reading about, people speculating in a few decades we may not even have anymore, back before the Endangered Species Act. And they are just common anymore as a nesting species. We've always had a lot of them in the winter in our area, but as a nesting species too anymore. You can see a bald eagle any month of the year in Missouri anymore.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, though, it's still special to see one
absolutely.
Of those things.
Absolutely. Still
and
a majestic
some
bird.
Wonderful places to see him, Bill. Like you say, along the Kaw River, Missouri River, the reservoirs, large reservoirs around town. They do eat fish. They'll hunt for fish in the wintertime if there's open water. They also follow the migration of waterfowl and will pick up the weak stragglers and feed on those. So
we've had a lot of open water this winter so far. Mm-hmm. So they're lingering around. If someone has a desire to see one, it shouldn't be too hard right now.
This may be just out of left field, but I was observing them from the opposite bank of the Kaw River. And they were communicating. They were screeching in some fashion. And I just wonder, I'm curious, what they might have been doing.
Well, I think they may have thoughts of spring.
Okay.
Could be. It's an interesting sound, though. And remember what it sounds like, it really isn't a very raptor-like sound. And you'll find that if you see TV commercials of eagles, they often substitute red-tailed hawk calls and other more ferocious sounding calls than the eagle's true call.
Are there any rules of thumb for observing a bald eagle in the wild?
Well, it's really interesting you bring that up, because the Missouri Conservation Department and other organizations in the Midwest have what they call Eagle Days, and Larry might be able to shed a little information on those.
Yeah, we have public viewing days. Most of them have occurred already. We had one at Smithville Lake in early January, and every year at Squaw Creek National Wildlife Refuge, one of the best ones you can go to is the first weekend in December. But as far as, like, if you're talking etiquette as far as viewing eagles or things like that, there really isn't, as except when it comes to nesting. If you know there's a nest there, for sure you don't want to approach that too closely. Mm-hmm. Other than that, you're not really going to disturb them.
My experience has been that they stay perched pretty high in the tallest trees, at least along the river.
Right. Yeah. I canoe in the Ozarks quite a bit and, you know, see them in overhanging trees sometimes on the river and, you know, 30, 40 feet over your head. And if you're quiet and don't make a lot of noise, you can float right under them. They don't even budge.
It's really interesting. They have a flight pattern in the mating display process where they will be flying together and then one will dip under the other, and they grasp talons together and tumble in the air for a little bit. Just watching them, I think, as you say, is very interesting.
That's fascinating.
Wonderful behavior.
Yeah. Okay, we can't get through an entire program without getting an update on the mountain lion. Larry, you're probably best one to address that. Which one? That may be it. It's just a handful of mountain lions, right?
Yeah, I forget the number we're up to now in Missouri. We've had a couple of recent ones, not close to here. I believe one was in Warren County, which is clear over on the eastern side of the state. We're up to somewhere approaching 20 verified sightings. I think I'm accurate in saying in Missouri. This has been since the mid-1990s. However, the interesting thing is most of those 20, or a good half or more of them, have occurred just in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years.
But they're not reproducing.
No, everything we've documented so far has been a male. I don't believe there's ever been a female in Missouri that I'm aware of yet. And that's typical. The ones we're seeing are young males that are becoming sexually mature and looking for their own territories. The thinking is these animals originate mostly in the Black Hills of South Dakota, where there's a huge population. And as ranges get occupied with mature males, these young ones don't have a place to go, so they strike out on their own and they can wander long distances.
Mm-hmm. One of my Twitter followers, at JewFroKC, sent me a message with a video attached, and he said he encountered a bobcat on a golf course in the metropolitan area. When I first looked at the video, it's about 35 seconds long, I'm thinking, that's a mountain lion, but I watched it a second time, and it was clearly just an incredibly large bobcat. Mm-hmm. So there are probably a lot of people who are making that same level of confusion.
That's true, but you know, with the use of these game cameras that people put out in the fields, and they're activated when by movement of an animal. People usually use them for deer, turkey, or whatever, but there have been some pictures that have come forth on those game cameras that have verified.
That is exactly how we verify most mountain lion sightings anymore. And it's important to say, yes, it's certainly possible you could see a mountain lion, but I can assure you we get many, many more reports of bobcats, yellow Labradors, and tabby cats as mountain lions than actual mountain lions. But that's not to say it's not possible.
Yeah, and that was just me. He was convinced that it was a bobcat. I was just surprised at the size of the thing and how close it came to their golf cart.
Mm-hmm. Well, bobcats are becoming more and more common around the urban area. It's just really kind of fascinating because most people, just don't recognize them. They think, well, that's a large cat. But they're usually active at nighttime and not very active during the day.
Other than your small pets, we want to make a point, too, that, I've seen some media reports of bobcats seen in the neighborhood, and it's kind of presented as kind of a scary thing, like it's going to eat your children. And not really a concern, but would be, if you have small dogs or house cats or things like that, be aware that's prey to them, just like the coyote situation that's occurred over in the Leawood area in the past, that kind of thing. But nothing to be frightened of.
Well, this was a long time ago, and I probably shared it with you two before, but I encountered a bobcat in the wild, and we both stopped dead in our tracks. And for a second, we were just both staring at one another, just completely stunned. And then it just turned and dashed back into the brush. But it was so it was a wonderful experience, short-lived.
What you described, Bill, is exactly like my first encounter with a bobcat. We did the same thing, just locked eyes with this thing. And the only thing moved was the tip of its tail flicking back and forth, and it took off.
That's Larry Rizzo. He's a natural history biologist. Joe Werner's here. He's a biologist and urban ecologist. Let's go to the phone lines. And Lucy is joining us from Lawrence. Good morning.
Yes. I have a question about box turtles. After last spring's unusually warm spell early on and then a cold snap afterwards, I didn't see any box turtles on the highway the whole summer afterwards. Has the box turtle population been impacted by the weather?
Lucy, this is Larry. I can't tell you that there's a correlation there. It's possible. Box turtle populations in many areas, though, are thought to be not particularly healthy. It has a lot to do with loss of habitat in some cases and lots of roads. You can't overestimate the toll that vehicles take on that species.
And they typically have a pretty small home range. They don't wander too awfully far.
That's right.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, have a nice day. From Facebook, Betsy Atkins writes, she's been seeing deer and have heard the coyotes at 435 and State Line, and she also reports seeing owls.
Don't find that unusual.
There's some great habitat there.
Yeah, you're right out there on some stream corridors there.
Mm-hmm. And there's just enough wooded areas and brush and so forth to make it accommodating.
As we know, coyotes are extremely adaptable, one of the most adaptable animals there is, and owls can make it in those areas just fine, and probably aware of them more now because they're getting really vocal as they get closer to nesting season.
Well, speaking of owls, Carrie has had an experience. Good morning, Carrie.
Morning. It was a few years ago, but I was out fairly early in the morning, about 7:30, and the sun was up, and driving down Lee Boulevard over in Leawood around 85th, and across the road in front of me swooped this massive bird that I finally figured out was probably a great horned owl. That's probably one of the coolest things I've ever seen in the city.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
And the other thing is, you were talking about the hawks and the squirrels and everything. And that's great because I don't want them eating my tomatoes. The other thing is, my mom has a small dog, a little Maltese, and she's become very careful about letting him out in the backyard unsupervised because she said that, she's heard that some of the neighbors have seen hawks in the neighborhood, and she doesn't want them thinking that her dog is their dinner.
Yeah, that's probably a good point, right, Joe?
Well, typically there's enough squirrels around that the hawks wouldn't take a dog too seriously.
Yeah,
it's always a possibility.
It's possible, and the dog has to be really small to be a prey item for most.
Well, he's maybe 5 pounds. He's little.
Yeah, that's small.
It is.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea, probably, but probably unlikely, but maybe not a bad thing to keep in the back of your head.
Okay, great show as always.
Thanks,
Carrie. Kenneth is joining us from Overland Park.
Hello. Hey, I was going to tell you, I went to Weston to snowboard New Year's Day, and there were three eagles circling the top. And they were up there for a long time. It was very cool. I mountain bike on Blue River over by Martin City, and I've seen a bobcat out there. And also on Tomahawk Creek Trail, where it goes under Metcalf, it's like 133rd and Metcalf, right over by the creek, if you go into the woods, there is me and my girlfriend call the scratching post, and it's where beavers have tried to take down this really big tree, and then they gave up. They've taken the bark off of this tree from about a foot up, about 2 feet all the way around it.
Interesting.
And, it's really cool. You can find it. I'm sure it's still out there. I don't think they're going to take it down anytime soon.
Yeah, Kenneth, the beaver actually are eating the bark off the tree.
Yeah, what nutrients do they possibly get from eating bark of a tree?
That's what they like.
Yeah.
They eat twigs, branches. They'll, of course, take a tree down and try to build a dam from time to time, too, or perhaps den up underneath the bank of a stream.
Uh-huh. How common are they in the metropolitan area?
They're not uncommon.
I would say very in the right places. Mm-hmm. One of the places that has an extremely high population is the Little Blue River.
Mm. Okay. 235-2888, 816-235-288. That's how you reach us. And David is calling us. David is in Independence. Hi, David.
Well, I guess my query is how did the turkeys make such a huge comeback? You know, when I was growing up, they weren't in, I mean, even in the wild, and now they're, you know, as I go to work, you know, most mornings or come home of an evening, they're alongside the road, you know, 291 or 470. It's just amazing how many there are in today's world. What has generated a comeback like this?
Well, David, in the early 1980s, the Missouri Conservation Department did several urban turkey releases along stream corridors, as an example, over in Swope Park or out
Lake
Burrow
Jacomo.
Woods, Lake Jacomo, and they've just done well. The habitat's there, and they've taken advantage of it.
I would have to say, though, back in that day, there were naysayers that would not have believed that turkeys would ever do that well in an urban area, and in fact, people that never would have believed they'd do so well in agricultural North Missouri. It was thought that turkeys required large blocks of unbroken forested land to live, and that's just not the case, as we can plainly see today.
Boy, I'll tell you what, though, that's a skittish bird. I've tried to get close to those things on numerous occasions, and it's next to impossible.
Very alert.
Even more so in rural areas, I can tell you from experience.
Yeah. and they're probably in abundance on both sides of the state line, I'm going to presume.
Oh, yes. Yeah. They've moved up the Blue River, and most of the, as Larry was saying, the wooded stream corridors.
Let's go. Let's talk to Joe now. Joe is calling from Leawood. Hey, Joe.
Good morning. The my question was about hawks, but some of the comments I've been hearing. I live near 435 in Mission, and similarly, on occasion, I've seen turkey and an occasional pair of red foxes. I haven't seen any coyotes. Don't mm-hmm. know when those come around, but my question I'm calling about is on occasion get glimpses of a smallish looking hawk that I think is preying on doves. But I can't really get a good look at it and kind of have a hard time identifying it. I wonder if you had any thoughts on that.
Joe, there's a couple of possibilities, and both of them are becoming more and more common in the urban area. The larger of the two would be a Cooper's hawk, and the smaller would be a sharp-shinned hawk. If you observe them in flight, they've got a very rectangular-shaped tail, a long tail that's banded.
Right. This one definitely had a band. It had a terminal white band.
Okay. And the only difference is the size. You might just check out a field guide and if you see him, try to...
The sharp-shinned's the smaller, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, because this is somewhere beside, bigger than a blue jay, but smaller than a crow.
Yeah, the difficulty, Joe, is that there's an overlap in size. The females are considerably larger than the males. So a male Cooper's hawk is relatively the same size as a female sharp-shinned. Mm-hmm. The little male sharp-shinned's only a blue jay-sized bird, and the female Cooper's is almost as big as a red tail. So but you can get online and look for some comparisons. It's one of those two, and they love doves because doves feed on the ground, and they're kind of slow on the takeoff, and they're also a nice meal. They're kind of chunky, so they take those a lot.
But and one quick question. When they mature, do their wings, the top of the bird gets darker like a gray? What's the coloration when they're from immature to a mature bird?
There is the most of the difference you see between mature and the immature bird is on the breast rather than the back of the bird. The immature ones have streaks run up and down. When they're mature, they have bars which go side to side. You can see that in pictures if you look that up.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Joe also made a good observation about seeing foxes in the neighborhood and mentioned he didn't see coyotes, and that's not unusual because coyotes eat foxes. So if you have foxes around, you probably don't have coyotes and vice versa.
I see. I saw a little fox just walking down the sidewalk in on the just inside the city limits of Lawrence when I was going home the other night. It was like one of those double take moments. Did I just see
exactly
a fox?
Neat little animal.
They are.
They're probably right next door here along Brush Creek somewhere, no doubt.
Yeah. This is a kind of an unfortunate aspect of living so close to humans, but I see a lot of, carcasses along the highway and the roadways. And I don't know that there's anything we can do to protect those wild animals, but how do you address that kind of a situation? I know in Europe they've tunneled under certain areas and so forth. Joe, I'm going to throw that at you.
Well, yeah, I've seen over in England where they've, especially with a lot of amphibians, they've made tunnels under the road for these crossings, and actually it can be quite dangerous if. You know, these amphibians get run over, the road becomes very slick. So it's also a safety issue. But as far as, just being alert as you drive, if you're driving through a wooded area, especially this time of the year, you may be on the alert for deer jumping out in front of you. It's just a matter of kind of watching and knowing where you are and what might be around.
Larry?
I'm going to put in another plug for box turtles here. That's a species that doesn't need to die on the roads to the extent that it does. It's very difficult when you're driving around. Sometimes in low light conditions, a deer will jump out in front of you. Box turtles don't do that. It's hard, to find a situation where you couldn't avoid a box turtle. It's a matter of paying attention. Mm-hmm. And if you're out driving in the country and you see box turtles on the road, one or two, you're probably going to see more.
Mm-hmm.
So you just need to be alert. Don't follow behind someone too closely because they go over one and you don't have time to react and you run over it. They can be avoided. There's no reason box turtles have to be slaughtered on our roads like they do. It's just a matter of watching out for them.
Would you encourage people to pull over in a safe spot and kind of help the turtle get across the roadway?
That's tricky, Bill, and I've done that lots of times.
Uh-huh.
And I know other people that have too, but of course you don't want to encourage that necessarily. You don't want anyone getting run over for that. But I don't do it in all situations, but if I have a wide shoulder and the traffic is low, I'll get out and do that.
You're listening to the Winter Spring is Around the Corner edition of Nature in the City on KCUR's Central Standard. Coming up, your spectacular, frightening, peculiar encounters with wildlife in and near the urban environment. Our phone number is 235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Give us those details. I'm Bill Anderson. This is KCUR and KCUR.org. And we're excited to have you listening at Central Standard and Nature in the City. I'm Bill Anderson. Talk to us. Talk to us about your experience. Our phone number, 235-2888. Again, it's 816-235-2888. Get some expert opinions from our guests, Larry Rizzo, a natural history biologist, and Joe Werner. He's our resident urban ecologist, and he's also a biologist. 235-2888. Perhaps you'd like to go to the KCUR Facebook page, and we'd like to incorporate you into the show that way, too. So let's talk, if we could. Let's stay on birds. And I'm going to go to Whitney Thuvanelli, who writes on Facebook. She made friends with a pelican. Now, this was in Florida, and it was a little vacation beach house, but she said this thing just kind of perched on the upper deck and stayed there long enough for her to get photographs. I guess it's probably looking for food, but
exactly.
But I do want to mention this. We have white pelicans that migrate through this area. I can't get very close to those things at all, so I'm shocked that Whitney was able to. Joe?
Yeah. Well, down in Florida, along the coast, Texas, Louisiana coast, whatever, the birds are much more acclimated to people sitting out on the piers. Fishermen will throw them fish.
I'm sorry. That's another species, too. That's a brown pelican down there.
So
very iconic bird along the Gulf, sitting on piers.
The pelicans don't necessarily act like...
No, and then the white pelicans, as you were saying, that migrate through here.
Yeah.
you know, are very skittish. In fact, they're, again, a very interesting bird to watch as they fly around, especially as they're coming in during migration and then leaving on the flight of migration. They just circle and get way up there and then catch the currents and they're off.
And when I've seen them, they've been in a row. Is that common?
In flight?
In flight.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Or in a V, like geese.
Well, actually, in the water, too, I've seen them kind of, kind of tagging one another.
The two pelicans are very interesting in their feeding behavior. And by the way, we've had brown pelican reports in Missouri in recent years. It seems like we've gotten about one a year, which is very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But white pelicans herd. They both eat fish, but they kind of herd fish together and scoop them up in their beaks, where the brown pelicans take the dramatic plunges from the air into the water after, if you're on a vacation on the Gulf Coast, it's a terrific thing to watch.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's back to the phones, and Pam has a question about birds.
Hi. Well, I have three things. First of all, box turtle rescues. I've done it, and I've also encountered people who stop to help me and also do the same thing. Mm-hmm. How do we safely hold them? Because they can get very, very disgruntled. Number two, in the big year, does that group exist where they go all over the place and count birds?
Yes.
Number three, there seems to be like these masses of small blackbirds. And all of a sudden, you feel like you're just in this huge flock, and, you know, they come down. What are they, and what causes this, where they just seem to be like thousands of them at one time? Okay.
Well, Pam, I'll take number three first, and that's the blackbirds. Okay. There's red-winged blackbirds and starlings and grackles. Actually, here in the Midwest, we literally get millions of blackbirds migrating through here, and it's more dramatic in the fall than in the spring, but you see these huge, huge flocks, and that's what you're probably referring to.
The big year question, again, there are definitely people that do that kind of thing, and there are people that do it even within state boundaries. You will have people that have a big year within the state of Missouri's political boundaries or Kansas, and people get very competitive about birding. It may be hard for some folks to believe, but it's definitely true. Mm-hmm. As far as handling box turtles, if you pick up a box turtle, hold it on both sides of the top shell, the carapace, with your hands, it can't reach back and bite you. And in my experience, the three-toed box turtle never even tries. The ornates will. I'm wondering, there are other turtles that cross roads, too, including snapping turtles.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And you can't pick up a snapping turtle that way. It has a longer neck, and it will reach you.
Oh, and it won't let go.
Yeah.
Till it thunders.
So,
just kidding.
With that, and then I have scooted snapping turtles off the road, but you want to, I've had boots on. I kind of nudge it off with the toe of my shoe, or you have a shovel or something to get them off. Don't try and pick up a snapping turtle.
Thanks, Pam. Tim is calling us, and he's got a story about this sounds pretty wild, Tim.
It was about 2 weeks ago at 1:30 in the morning. I live in Plattsburgh. Up county seat of Clinton County, and there was a scream going on, and I thought it was a baby in the house, and then I listened closer, and it was blood-curdling, went on for about 3 to 4 minutes, and I'm looking out my window towards the Concord Lake, and I could see an animal running, chasing something, or something was chasing it, and I don't know, I talked to some folks later, they said it was a mountain lion, and some folks think it may have been a bobcat. But at 1:30 in the morning, it was blood-curdling. I wish I had enough sense to record it to see if it would be a mountain lion.
Well, let's have the guys weigh in on this.
Yeah.
Either is possible, Tim, but I'm guessing mating season for bobcats.
Or it could have been a fox. Red foxes have a very...
They have a weird call.
Weird call, yeah.
Do bobcats?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's a scream.
And because he's saying it was a large animal.
Yeah.
So
if you've had mating feral cats around your house at night, you know the sorts of sounds they can make. And bobcats would do something similar at the right time of year.
Okay. Because somebody had said that they've seen, or those folks up in the Clinton County area, that mountain lions are in the area. And it's quite... curious to see which it would be. But it wouldn't. I know it wasn't a fox. I know it was bigger than a fox.
Yeah. Well, Tim, thanks for the phone calling, and lock your doors tonight.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One other thing, though, I drive down every day on C and A to get into the metro area, and in 2011, the roadkill in October, and I kept a daily total, kind of weird, but I kept a daily total on the roadkill. It was enormous, and this past fall in October, it was less than 10% of the previous year.
Wow.
What was it, the drought that really cut down on the production of possums and raccoons and skunks?
Yeah, well,
boy, Tim, that's really difficult to say. You know, maybe all the roadkills in the previous years have cut the population back.
Interesting observation, though.
Yeah, no kidding. I see what animals that look like wolves along the roadway, but it's probably a German. It's probably a dog, right?
Coyotes.
Coyotes are very, very common.
Okay. Boy, it sure doesn't look like a coyote, though.
Yeah. Well, dogs and coyotes will cross with dogs. They will interbreed.
Okay. And that must be what it is then. Let's go to, I believe it's, if I'm not mistaken, it's Mike. Hi, Mike.
Yes. Hello.
You're on the air, sir.
Okay. Hey, I have an interesting little, I'll call this story, the squirrel versus the hawk. And who wins? I was watching a squirrel enjoy my bird seed out on my deck, and all of a sudden he froze. And I wondered why he was frozen in that position for a few seconds. So I looked out farther on the back, and I saw a Cooper's hawk sitting on the fence. So they were, I didn't know if they were kind of watching each other or what. But as I watched, another squirrel came out of a tree and was running down the fence, the same fence that the hawk was sitting on, and was running towards the hawk. So I said, well, this is going to be lunchtime for the hawk. But as the squirrel kept approaching, the hawk didn't move at all. And finally, the squirrel got up to the hawk, stood up on his back legs, and probably made a sound or did something, and the hawk flew away. I was quite surprised to see, you know, it's just the opposite of what I would have expected.
Not surprising to me, Mike. Cooper's hawk is not a threat to a squirrel. They're just not big enough to tackle a squirrel. They don't normally eat mammals. Hmm. And animals instinctively know which predators they have to be afraid of and not.
No kidding.
I used to work at a nature center where we had a huge bird feeding area. We had lots of squirrels and lots of birds. And when a Cooper's hawk flew in or a sharp-shin hawk, birds scattered. There's not a bird out there full of squirrels. They didn't care. They could care less. Total opposite if a red-tailed hawk came in. Birds could care less. They weren't threatened by it. The squirrel, you wouldn't see a squirrel.
Mm-hmm. I'll be darned. Well, do Cooper's hawks eat any kind of animals?
I wouldn't rule out a Cooper's hawk taking a very small rodent or something, but they're really a bird-eating hawk.
Yeah. Okay.
Have a nice day, Mike.
It was very interesting. Phil, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I was just thinking, there are a lot of different terrains and even probably some subtle climate changes or subtle climate differences between Kansas and Missouri. Is that reflected in the wild animal life that exists in the two states?
Well, one of the big differences is the amount of rainfall. Western Kansas, compared to our area, you know, if you look at the different habitat, it's a short grass prairie or tall grass prairie as you come east. And in Missouri, this is where the prairie meets the eastern deciduous forest. So there's a lot of differences associated with that. I mean, it all comes down to the habitat.
Okay. Larry?
Yeah, I agree. But particularly using that example, if you take the extremes of the range from western Kansas compared to, say, eastern Missouri or the Ozarks, totally different flora and fauna.
How long would this drought need to sustain itself in order for us to see, a change in the kind of wildlife that inhabits this part of the country? Any way to, gauge that?
Boy, I wouldn't.
No?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you'd expect to see many things different as far as new species or something, but it'd be more numbers of what's already here, either increasing or, don't forget, there are animals that benefit from drought, so increasing or decreasing what you already have rather than new things coming around. But it's not impossible if it went over time.
And if we have milder winters, the animals that, are more southern-oriented, that are constantly pushing their way north. They'll mm-hmm. come further north. The armadillo is a good example of that that we've seen.
Roadrunners.
Now,
are
there armadillos reproducing in Missouri and Kansas?
Oh, yes.
Definitely.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Armadillos are well established as far north as the Truman Lake area. Mm-hmm. I have seen road-killed ones here in Jackson County, certainly in Cass County.
Well, that's all I've seen. I haven't seen one alive, and I'm just wondering what kind of a habitat do they exist in?
Well, they're kind of generalists in a lot of ways.
Pretty much diggers. They'll dig for their
deeper soil,
and things of that sort. Yeah, so it's got to be some pretty decent soil.
In the Ozarks.
Although they thrive in the Ozarks pretty well.
Yeah, in the Ozarks, though, even I think I tend to see more of them in bottomlands and things where there's more insects and worms and things that they dig.
That's Larry Rizzo. He's a natural history biologist. Joe Werner is here. He's also a biologist. He's an urban ecologist. We'd like to hear from you at 235-2888. Perhaps you'd like to leave a message on Facebook. We'll do our best to get that on the airwaves. Let's talk to Andrew. Andrew's calling in from Lawrence.
Hi. Thanks for letting me on the program. I am an environmental studies student out at KU, and I had the opportunity as a field trip to go with the Kansas Ornithological Society for bird watching trips.
Great.
And I had such a great experience meeting all of these people that taught me how to, view birds and taught me about the different species and get to see really rare things that I normally wouldn't be able to pick out on my own. And does Missouri also do something like that also?
Andrew, I think that's just a very great opportunity for people that want to learn more is to associate with an organization like that, or here in the metropolitan area, the Audubon Society, the Burroughs Audubon Society, or most of the nature centers around town here, whether they be private or public, we'll have guided tours like that. And I think you'll find that most of those folks are just very friendly and willing to share and teach you things as you have experienced. So that's great.
Yeah, they love to have new folks. So, I would look up the website of the Burroughs Audubon Society and familiar with their meetings and their field trips. They have regular field trips throughout the year.
Yeah, thanks a lot, guys.
Sure.
You're welcome. Let's talk to Elizabeth. And Elizabeth is also calling from Lawrence. Elizabeth, are you there? Let's talk to Bob in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I have a question about chipmunks.
Okay.
You go right ahead,
great,
sir.
We have chipmunks all through the summer, spring and fall, live in our rock wall. But we don't see them in the winter. Do they just stay in the den, or do they actually hibernate? They look way too small to hibernate, but what do I know?
Really, really good question, Bob, and the answer is yes and no. Chipmunks do hibernate, but it's to kind of varying degrees in different parts of their range, from what I understand. In very northern parts, they are a true hibernator, which means their body temperature drops. They get as hard as a rock, and they don't come out until spring. And other times, they where it's more warm, like here, they will wake up sometimes during the winter, and not what you'd refer to as a true hibernator. But they definitely say they spend a lot of time in the winter, particularly when it's cold, in their burrows underground, waiting out till spring. I have them in my neighborhood, in my yard, too. I enjoy watching them.
Yeah, they're quite cute. Amazingly fast for animals that size. Our dogs try to chase them, but they've never caught one.
So do mine. Yeah, it's usually a futile effort there.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah.
All right, thanks. Bye.
In the rare occurrences of rainfall in this part of the country, I've observed squirrels just kind of going about their business with no regard, not taking any protection from the rain or even the snowfall. How do they do that? I know they're well clothed, so to speak, but how the heck do they survive?
Fur is a marvelous thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just incredible.
It really is. They're adapted. I mean, it's they've got their body heat that will evaporate the moisture as it gets on them. And
consider the mammals that make their living in the water in the winter, under the ice, beaver, otters, muskrats, things like that. Really amazing, but they can do it.
Yeah. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard on KCUR. And now we're going to talk to intrepid reporter Suzanne Hogan, one of our colleagues here at KCUR. And Suzanne's been working, kind of working the crow beat. Hi, Suzanne.
Yeah, am I on the air?
You are. Good morning.
Hi, well, Suzanne. I've been trying to work the crow beat. Around Christmas time, there's a large group of crows that decided to live over my house for about a week. And it was my house and just my neighbors, and we lived kind of on top of a hill. And they were roosting there every night, all coming together, and I want to say like hundreds, maybe even like 1,000. And at one point, I even caught them all gathering in the Costco parking lot over on Linwood right before they'd kind of come over to my house. And so I decided that I wanted to start trying to record them. But then once I decided I wanted to do that, they've decided to move to other places, I guess, because I've been hearing that they've been at 11th and Paseo, some other parts around the city. And I've had other friends mention that they see large groups of crows gathering, which I guess is common around this time of year. But I have heard that there's more crows kind of gathering in large urban areas than maybe there were before, because I guess it's warmer in urban areas and there's less owls and predators that can get to them. So, yeah, it's just been an observation. And they leave quite a nasty aftermath the next day. I'm still scrubbing off parts of my driveway.
Well, Joe, what do you make of this?
Well, as Suzanne said, you know, the urban crow is becoming legendary. You know, these roosts, and some of these roosts can have thousands of birds, you know, and they're well protected in the city, as Suzanne said. There's fewer predators. You know, the staging areas that she's talking about. In the wintertime, what happens is, you know, during the day, the crows leave the roost in the morning. They go out to the McDonald's or wherever and find their food.
They separate, right?
Separate.
Yeah.
They spread out.
Yeah.
And then they'll start gathering in the early afternoon. And these are called staging areas, and that's what Suzanne was seeing at the Costco as an example. And then they'll finally come together at dusk at a roost and spend the evening there. And these roosts will move around town. There used to be one that was within a quarter mile of the station here.
I've seen them right outside the back door here en masse. Yeah.
Anywhere up and down Brush Creek used to have large flower in the plaza
now,
sometimes.
Now I'm looking for them.
Yeah,
and you're not having much luck, are you?
And I can't find them. I drive around dusk looking for them, and I try to follow them. They just—it's like when I didn't want them, they were there, and now I can't find them for the life of me.
How many days did they stay near your house, Suzanne?
It was about a week.
About a week.
And they were really, really loud. It was to the point where they would just move from tree to tree, and it almost sounded like an ocean wave, you know, because of all the sound of their wings. And then it also sounded like it would be raining sometimes because they'd be pooping at such a steady stream that it kind of sounded like trickling raindrops. It was kind of gross, but, I mean, there's just that many of them.
Yeah, geez. Have you seen Hitchcock's The Birds, that 1963 film?
I have, and that's the thing. It was scary at first, but then, and I didn't like them because they were annoying, but now, like, they kind of grew on me, and I really kind of grew to like watching them and thought they were beautiful and appreciated them, and now I can't find them.
Suzanne, maybe somebody could call in and let us know where they're roosting now.
Yeah, I can go ahead and record them.
Well, thanks for taking time out of your day, Suzanne.
Yeah, no problem. Have a good one.
All right, you too. 235-2888, that's the number that Suzanne called in on, and we'd like to hear from you. What kind of experiences with wildlife have you had, or what kind of questions do you have for our experts? And Larry, I think you wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, I was just going to tie in the crows to a topic we mentioned earlier, and that's roadkill, and that's another source of food for them around here, as well as trash containers. When I was a kid, people had free-roaming dogs in the neighborhood. That wasn't unusual then. And people, they would tear into people's trash. Nowadays, it's some neighborhoods, it's crows, because they know what's in trash bags, and they're smart enough and big enough to tear into them. I've seen them do it a number of times.
Let's talk to Elizabeth. She's in Lawrence. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Yes. Good morning. Can you hear me all right?
We sure can.
What I was calling about is, actually, I have two questions. The one is, I saw a program on NPR several years ago that beavers were really misunderstood, and they were good for erosion. Whether that's true or not, I'd like to know. And the other question is are otters protected in Kansas? And I go to a private lake. We have a large population of beavers. The one problem we have is they eat the docks. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is the otters have been showing up, and of course nobody's going to bother the otter. But I want to know, how are both of them protected?
Hey, Elizabeth, before we let you go and get an answer for you, is that out in the Lakeview area, northeast or northwest of Lawrence?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great place. It's gorgeous, and that's a great place for wildlife, by the way. But we'll get we're going to get
you. Love it. They love the wildlife, and I'm one of the members there, and I'm very interested in protecting the wildlife.
Yeah, let's get an answer for her. Joe?
Well, I'm not sure about the protection or the status of otters in Kansas, but I believe in Missouri, Larry, there is a trapping season currently.
Yes, otters can be trapped in Missouri during the normal trapping season. Otherwise, they're protected.
Yeah, I would suggest you contact the local office of Kansas Wildlife and Parks and see what the status is of the otter in Kansas. But as far as beavers being good for erosion, you know, typically what they'll do, you know, is actually denude an area and cause erosion potentially.
Okay. Mm. Yeah,
but beavers are, you know, like a lot of things, in it depends on the situation they're in. They are certainly a natural part of the environment, and they're one of the biggest shapers of habitat there is out there. Left to their own devices, they're generally beneficial to an ecosystem, but when it's your dock or your trees you've planted, you might not feel so favorable to them.
In the 30 seconds that we have left, Joe, I'm going to throw this at you. Reggie from Shawnee, I apologize, sir, I can't get you on the air, but he's seeing a lot of seagulls around a dump out there, and he just simply wants to know where those gulls are coming from.
Actually, the gulls that we have around here that, you know, are migrating through here, ringbill gull is a pretty common one in the Midwest. They'll migrate south, nest north of us.
Great Lakes headed to the Gulf a lot of times, or back and forth.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's Larry Rizzo. He's a natural history biologist. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome, Bill. I want to take this opportunity, Bill, if I can, to say hi to a longtime Nature in the City participant, Carla Bascom.
Yes.
And her cousin, her husband, Kevin, live down in the Ozarks now, and she still listens to the show. And I think she just had a birthday, so happy birthday, Carla.
Yeah, happy birthday, Carla. And that's Joe Werner, biologist and urban ecologist. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Bill.
You can listen to this episode again, subscribe to our podcast, or explore any of our past episodes at kcur.org. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Kim Noble is our announcer. Next on Up to Date, a look at a group that's trying to prepare women to stand for public office. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard.